Welcome, everyone. My name is Barbie Breakout. I am an author, an activist, and a non-binary drag queen from Berlin, Germany, and your host of this podcast episode today. This podcast is called Tragisch aber geil, which doesn't really translate into English. In German, it means something like tragic, but kind of hot. Yeah, I know. It doesn't really translate. But hey, I usually... I've done two seasons of this in German, and usually I invite people from all walks of life, all different backgrounds. Usually it's queer people, but we do make exceptions. We do not discriminate. And I talk to them about their life experience. I talk to them about where they came from, how they were raised, first trauma, how they survived it, how they've grown from it, and what we as an audience can maybe take away from their lived experience and apply that to our own lives. Sometimes it's also just nice to listen. But today I know we're going to learn a lot because I have invited one of my personal heroes, Alok. I jumped at the opportunity when I was asked if I wanted to record this, if I wanted to do this interview. I was like, God, yes. Because Alok for me is one of those people that I followed them on social media for years and years and years, and every time that I stop on their profile and I listen to something or I watch a video, I learn and I grow, and I'm just grateful that they found the time to grace us with their presence today. And I will say this, the audio quality isn't what I usually have, but that's just due to the fact that we did this on such a short, like, we didn't really have time to set it up, and Alok was getting, like, they had to pack, they were getting ready to board a plane and come to Germany, and so, you know, them being in the US, me being in Berlin, Germany already, so yeah, you know, it's I did my best in editing to edit out any, like, background noises and cars and sirens and shit, but you will still hear a little bit of that. So forgive me for this. But without further ado, let's just jump right in. So welcome, everyone, to a long overdue episode, my first episode in English. And I have an amazing, amazing guest today. They are a poet, a writer, a performance artist, and... one of my personal heroes, actually. So welcome, Alok. Thank you so much for doing this. I know you're very, very busy at the moment.
Thanks for having me.
And you are so busy, among other things, because you're getting ready for your German tour, because your first book, Beyond the Gender Binary, just got translated into German. Now it's called Mehr als Binär, and you can get that at Catalyst Verlag. I will put a link into the show notes. Congratulations, first of all. You are going to be doing 5 different cities, 5 different shows in 5 different cities in Germany. Is everything sold out already, or do some people still have a chance to get a ticket?
There's still tickets left for Munich, Frankfurt, and Cologne.
Gorgeous. So usually, I mean, a lot of the people that are listening today are going to be listening for the first time, so I'm going to explain this. Usually in my podcast, we always start at the very beginning. We always go back to childhood. We go back to, you know, first trauma, all those, like, yummy things. And then we're trying to learn how you went through those experiences, because of a lot of the people listening are probably sharing the same experiences or similar ones, how you navigated through them, how you survived them, maybe what you learned. And then we're going to go to how your life turned out, how you became the person that you are today. And maybe we can find something that people can learn from that. So you were born in Texas, of all places, right?
Yeah, correct.
Tell me a little bit about that. How was that?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the place where I'm from in Texas might confirm what German audiences stereotypes people might have about Texas. Not all of Texas is about cowboys, but my town was. So deeply conservative. I called it homo on the range. I was just different in so many different ways in terms of gender, race, sexuality, religion, you name it. Right. And looking back, I'm actually really grateful, because from a young age, I had to ask myself really deep questions about what the purpose of life was and why I needed to be on Earth and how to continue to exist, even though people didn't want me to. And it gave me a kind of grit that I feel like allows me to do the work that I do today. But at the time, it was pretty brutal. And I think I'll spend my entire life being able to process the emotions that I wasn't able to when I was younger in Texas.
You are talking about all the bullying that you had to go through as a teenager in the book. But there is, pretty early on, there's this story of you, at I'm thinking 5 years old, joyfully dancing to Bollywood music for your family and I guess friends of the family, I don't know. And you're saying later that you weren't able to confide in your parents about the bullying, that you felt like you couldn't tell them. But in that first scene, they seem so like a loving, close-knit family, like they're really loving people.
Yeah, I was really lucky because I had a lesbian aunt. So she kind of did a lot of the work for me. And I only found this out later in my life, but she basically told my parents, like, hey, I think your kid is queer. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that they're safe. If you have any questions, consult me. And so she was behind the scenes sort of working with my family, even my extended family, to make sure that I was okay. And that is like such an enormous source of validation as a young person.
Yeah.
Because I didn't ever think that queer people were what people said that they were. I was being told by my community that queer people were wrong and dangerous and bad. But then I met my aunt and her friends and I was like, okay, that's not true. So I always had the idea that I could grow up and I could live a queer life. I just thought that that would only happen in New York City though.
Not in Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had this image from, like, in my own life growing up. There's a lot of parallels, by the way, to the way that, to the experiences that you made as a kid. And I always had this image that I would be able to grow up gay and that I would be able to be like a queer person and maybe even a happy queer person one day. But I knew from like TV shows and films that there would be a price to pay, that I would have to be expecting violence. I would have to be expecting horrible things happening to me because that's what I had seen on TV. Was that the same for you?
Yeah, definitely expecting violence, definitely expecting abandonment, definitely doubting even the kind of presumption of love in my family. I was like, no, they can't really. They're supportive right now because they don't know, but once they know, then a lot of sense of like, okay, they might be okay with LGBTQ people in abstract, but not their own child. I had all these narratives of impossibility still. And if anything, that speaks to the extent of the homophobia and transphobia in Texas is despite all of the intentions of my family, because I've had these conversations with them now after the fact, where they're very shocked and surprised that I still have these beliefs. And I try to communicate to them, like, I don't think you understood the kind of bullying that I was experiencing at school. Like, where I grew up, people would joke about making an Armageddon fight where all gay people had to kill each other on a separate island so that they couldn't infect people with HIV and AIDS. And this would be like a conversation at the age of 7. Like execution of gay people.
Grown-ups would be having those conversations?
No, my peers. Oh, my peers. Fuck. Yeah, so it wasn't just like gay people are sissies. It was we don't want gay people to exist in the world whatsoever. And then it was like I remember when I was in 5th or 6th grade, one of our teachers people thought were gay, and I saw the way that people made fun of him. Like he carried a tote bag, and in Texas having enough. A tote bag was seen as too feminine and therefore gay, and like people just treated him so cruelly and felt like they could, even though they were his students, because that gave them the right. And I think he ended up leaving that school district actually. So I saw these extreme examples of what happens to people who are visible, and I internalized that. So I think I used all these logics that I see other people use against me now, where I would say, even if I am gay, I'm not flamboyant or I'm not feminine. I'm just like other people. I'm a regular, normal person. I'm not visible. And my identity was defined by my self-hatred.
You said, you wrote about it on Facebook. I think I found an older post that you attempted suicide. Was that around that age, in that time?
Yeah, totally. That was when I was a teenager, just starting out. And yeah, that was because I think I came to the series of decisions where I was like, who I am is incompatible with this world. It was never like, this is something that I want. It was, I can't even tell what I want because other people have already figured it out for me. And that's why I think it's really powerful, the reframing of the language these days, where people, at least here in the United States, are saying it's not that people commit suicide, it's that they die by suicide. And what that rephrase actually does is it shows that like mental health and suicide aren't just things that are shared by individuals. They're byproducts of systems and cultures and societies. So it's not individual people's fault. It's a collective responsibility.
Right. We might touch on the 41% thing later if we have the time, but tell me, how did you get out of this mindset after you failed? Thank God. But how did you get out of that? What helped you? What changed?
Yeah, I think a lot of things, but I think chiefly among them, it was meeting other queer people. Something that I didn't really have the luxury to do in Texas. So it was only when I started going to university in California. And for the first time, I found myself enmeshed in a very tight-knit queer community. And all of these tropes that I had heard about queer life, all of these stereotypes, all of these mischaracterizations fell apart because I found queer people who were delightful and whimsical and camp and flamboyant and wonderful and beautiful and loved me before I was capable of loving myself, saw me for my bullshit, and were like, oh, you have internalized homophobia? That's not cute. I had that too. Grow up. And I realized that I was in a state of arrested development because I think to grow up in a straight cis society as a queer person is in many ways to never be allowed to flourish and grow and expand. And that's why meeting queer people has historically always been the ways that we grow and expand. Like the term coming out actually, and in the context of the US at least, comes from the history of debutante balls, where in debutante society, it'd be like you're announcing someone to the society. It's giving very Bridgerton vibes. But in the queer community, it meant basically you're being introduced to the queer underground. So you're coming out to start going to queer parties to like integrate into queer nightlife and queer worlds and queer art. There's always been a sort of sense of collectivity and community to coming out. It was never an individual action. And so I think that for me, community has always been foundational. Friendship has always been foundational to self-acceptance. Like we become our best selves through other people.
But it's not always the first people you meet after coming out. For me, it took a long time of going out. I started going out like 13, 14-ish to the gay nightlife. And I think I only met like people who were like me, who are like my tribe, 98, 99. So yeah, with 20. And then when I moved to Berlin is when it really worked. That happened at Stanford for you, right? That was the college that you went to, top of your class. I watched this Man Enough podcast episode that you posted on your website. And it was like, I mean, every time I'm listening to you, I've been following you for years. Every time I'm listening to you, there's like those like statements of like insane eloquence and profundity. And in this podcast, you were like, yeah, but that's my trauma response. Like I had to become the smartest person in every room. in order to counteract this internalized belief that I'm basically unlovable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that still something that's with you today, this kind of mindset?
Yeah, 100%. It's a very strange thing to be congratulated and rewarded for something that comes from such a sinister and sad place.
Mm.
My work ethic, my ability to articulate, my ability to deconstruct arguments, all of that came from a foundational sense of unlovability and fear of violence. So these were all strategies that I was deploying in order to make my life livable, worthy, to make my life defensible by other people. Mm. Okay, Alok's a faggot, but at least they're smart.
Mm.
Like I had something to offer to society. And I think as an adult now, I'm having to ask myself the very difficult question of, do I have worth for being not doing? And that's something that I think is easy to say rhetorically, but to actually materialize in your life is extremely difficult. Like I ask myself, why am I working so hard?
Hmm.
Why is it so difficult for me to decompress? And it's still because I'm battling with this narrative that I'm not enough. And that I have to earn my right to be here as a queer person.
Mm.
And I see this actually among so many queer people is this sense of being an imposter. Like we have to, like we're living on stolen time. Mm. Like, okay, we weren't supposed to be here anyways. We were supposed to be dead. And so because we didn't die, then we have to work extra hard to prove why we're here. And I think that for a long time I felt a lot of shame for it, but shame doesn't actually get us where it promises that it's taking us.
Mm.
It actually makes us double down in our tomfoolery so often. So now I'm trying this rogue and punk thing of loving even the parts of myself that I feel shame about, and trying to understand where they came from and have compassion for that and figure out what I want to keep with me and what I want to discard. So what I want to keep is a probing sense of intellect. But what I want to discard is that's where I get my worth from. Mm. What I want to keep is like a deep and inquisitive and questioning nature. But what I want to get rid of or discard is my refusal and inability to rest. To be able to turn off sometimes. I think that I'm just now at 31 years old learning how to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a difference between our anxious breath, which is in fight or flight, and the diaphragmic breath, which is deeper and rooted. And I think I'm just aware of the fact that I haven't really actually been breathing my entire life.
Yeah. It's a PTSD thing also for me, like the breath thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it helps. This is going to sound horrible and I apologize. I apologize now for how it's going to sound. I used to, like your look used to make me uncomfortable. And I only realized it today, like when I sat down to prepare for this interview and I started writing things down, I realized this, like when I started telling people that I was non-binary, when I started talking about it, I made it a point to distance myself from you and the way you, not you as a person, but the way you dressed, because in my head or subconsciously, I thought that if I distance myself, then if I presented male during the day, if I kept my femininity for my drag character and didn't bother people with my queer appearance during the day, I would be doing something right. And I only realized this today writing this down. I was like, oh shit, I did you dirty. Like I did the same thing to you that society does to us. And I did the same thing to myself also. Like I was rejecting your aesthetic because it made me feel safer. It made me feel more comfortable with who I was coming out as. And I sincerely apologize for that. Is that something, though, that happens to you a lot? Mm. Is that something that you experience a lot?
Mm. Yeah, it's something that I experience with myself.
Okay.
Still. Mm. Like, I often, after the fact, like, in the moment, I'll be feeling so beautiful and powerful and incandescent. And my look, and then I'll look at a photo or a video, and I'll be like, ew. Mm. And then I have to ask myself, whose gaze am I looking at myself from? Mm. Is this actually what I believe, or is this what society is telling me to believe about myself? Whose fear is this? Whose shame is this? Mm. And it's not my own. And I forgive myself for even having that as negative self-talks, because of course we internalize the garbage of society. I'm less interested in people acknowledging that. In fact, I need everyone to acknowledge that. Mm. As I am, and what people do once they know it. Mm. And I think that many people just go on autopilot and believe what they told that they have been told to believe, and don't actually do the more difficult and introspective work to ask how their disgust and how their disdain says more about them than it says about me. Mm. And that's the work that I want all of us to do. And I think that as queer people and as trans people, we often displace culpability to straight and cis people, but I think it's also our collective responsibility to acknowledge the ways in which we too have internalized homophobia and transphobia, and how that has been implemented into our movements, so that it became easier to say we're just like you and to be palatable than it is to be able to say maybe we're not. And maybe we shouldn't have to look like you or act like you. And maybe we should still be worthy of safety and validity. Mm. That maybe we get to change our minds. That's a big one I've been thinking about recently. I think as non-binary people, because there's so much conservative fear-mongering about us, we have to say, this is who I am and this is what I've always been. And I'm actually like, what about our fluidity? We're allowed to change.
Right. It's very absolute. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can change what we want to be every single day. Mm. And each one is just as true and valid. Like, it's unfair that we have to like be held to this extreme and impossible standard of like certainty. It's also aesthetically unambitious to me. I'm like, I want to be able to change my look all the time and not worry that like invalidates my gender. Right. That's obnoxious.
It's the whole Demi Lovato situation where like, she changed her pronouns today and then she changed it back. And then people were like, oh my God, she was just putting this on. It was just a show. It was just a press thing. Well, I'm like, yeah, but it's fluid. Like you get to try things on and then decide that they don't work for you or not right now.
100%.
Yeah.
And I just worry that like, that fluidity piece is being lost. Like I've just noticed, and I noticed this in myself too, when things live in language, but we don't allow them to live in people. Mm. So when we have like political imaginations that will say things like gender is fluid, but then when we actually see it, we get so deeply uncomfortable with it. So then you begin to notice the language actually is a shield that prevents us from the embodiment. Mm. That's the problem with my intellect, is that I can think about things and narrate things, but not feel them in my body, just remain dissociated. And I think that our politics are so dissociated where we speak about intersectionality, but then when it's actually confronting us, we're like, no, that's too much.
Yeah.
We speak about fluidity, but when it's confronting us, it's too much. And that's because we haven't really integrated our mind, our body, and our soul into our political imaginations. And that's the work that I'm trying to do as an artist, is to say, okay, we can learn all these things discursively or intellectually, but what does it mean to really feel it in our body? And what does it mean to really become okay with queerness and transness at that level? How can you tell me that you accept non-binary people, and yet the entire way that you live your life and your gender is a deep and sincere investment in the gender binary?
Same.
The gender binary is not just something that non-binary people get to challenge. It's something that we all actually have to challenge and feel more ambivalent about.
Yeah. What you just said really hit home, though. Just the other day, I was getting ready. I was invited to a friend's house for dinner. And it was like I wanted to have long hair, so I put on a wig. I felt like having long hair was one of those days. And I felt so uncomfortable getting ready. And I didn't realize what it was until I was like, oh, shit. It's exactly what you just said. I had fought for the right for every non-binary person to dress however femme they want. I had written about it. I had talked about it in countless podcasts. But I hadn't really applied it to my own life. Like, it was still that thing, like I said earlier, where it's like I'm trying to, like, be a good non-binary person by not by not dressing this way every day, you know, by trying to be safer and more comfortable for people. And like after I put on the wig, it was all fine. I went there, they were lovely. Her kids played with my hair, everybody loved it. Nobody looked at me strangely. It was just in my head. And it's like you said, it was the disconnect between what it is in the language and what it actually is in real life experience. And that was wild for me.
But that's why I see adornment and dressing up as a political practice and a spiritual practice and a therapeutic practice. Because what it takes for us to exist in society, visibly queer and trans, no words would ever be able to explain that experience of having to enter a room and scan for every exit sign, of having to be on a train and lock eyes with every single person there to evaluate, is this person going to retaliate against me? And then alongside that, the sense of joy and relief of seeing another visibly gender nonconforming person there and being like, oh my God, I'm not alone. Like, I love you. Like, that experience, that is such a supercharged experience that has taught me so much about self-acceptance and surrender than language never could. There's no argument that I could ever give that would be, hey, go outside knowing that people won't accept you. In fact, they might even hunt you. They might even degrade and mock you, but do it anyways. That's anti-language. That's anti-logic. That's anti-reason. But it's pro-beauty. And I think what is so powerful about beauty is it surpasses reason, and it actually is a deeper and more holistic and integrated sense. And what I found in my own life, getting dressed and getting ready and putting on makeup and putting on wigs and putting on dresses, is that it actually allowed the language to seep into my body in a different way. It allowed me to really feel these things in a different way and to confront the indelible fact that the shame is not my own. That's the experience I get all the time, is I feel this immediate judgment from society. And old me would have been like, it's because I'm wrong. It's because I don't exist. And now me, I'm like, this is your pain that you're putting on to me because you too want to be this free. And you too have a sincere and earnest desire to express yourself. But someone told you that you couldn't and you believe them. And so when you see me, you have to suspend that belief for a second. And it is easier to degrade and belittle me than it is to confront the pain that you don't know who you are outside of what you've been told you should be. And I'm so sorry that you have been taught that love is self-immolation, that you've had to destroy and decimate your own soul in order to be loved by other people. But guess what? That's not love. What love looks like is show me who you are. And I'm doing this today, not just because I love myself, but because I love you. And now that's an exercise that I can go through every day. And that's something that I never would have accessed had I just read about it or talked about it or thought about it. And so that's what I would like to see more of in our movements, is an appreciation for the nonverbal, an appreciation for ways of being queer that are messy and unruly, that don't fit into language. Experiences that we've had that we can't even narrate because they are spiritual. Like, a lot of times people ask me, how do you have compassion for people who are cruel to you? And I can't really give an explanation because it's a deeply felt sense of like, I love people so much. Because I, when I'm experiencing street harassment, I'm able to understand at a deep and somatic level in my body now, like, this is other people's repression. Like, that's a knowledge that I don't think I would have gotten unless I took the step of incarnating myself in this form.
Right. But it really feels like you're seeing the Matrix as, you know, compared to the rest of us, where it's like when you get harassed, there's like, for me, there's still terror and fear and so much anger that I want to unleash back onto them. And I've seen you time and time again on social media respond with so much kindness and trying to help them understand why they're writing this. And that's just amazing to me. But talk to me a little bit about the political situation right now for trans people in the US. I mean, it's incredible how much of like bullshit legislation they came up with in such a short amount of time to vilify trans people. I mean, in the UK, it's been an ongoing process as well. I feel like it's going to be in the rest of Europe. I don't understand why we're being targeted that way. Like, what? I don't understand the takeaway for them, the gain. Is it just like smokes and mirrors? Are they trying to distract the world from other things? Is it trying to find like the lowest common denominator? I don't get it.
Yeah. You know, I think that Germany needs to be the global leader in this conversation because of history. This is an old playbook that we know very well of taking a vulnerable minority, using the press and politics to scapegoat them as having access to some mythological power that isn't actually manifest, as part of a conservative and fascist practice of oppressing all of us. And it is really sad to me that we're making the same mistakes over and over and over and over again, and not learning from history, and not learning how fear can be weaponized, and how people's legitimate concerns around the economy, around war, around political instability can be so easily diffused into the narrative of, if we just get rid of this group of people, then we'll be okay. Yeah. I just wish that we'd connect the dots. Yeah. And I think what feels so sad for me as a trans person is that even communities in my country that have been historically marginalized by the same practice, immigrants, people of color, religious minorities, are often people who will still participate in this transphobia. Mm. So it begins to realize, like, wait, a lot of times people aren't actually fighting for freedom or for equity. They're fighting for privilege to do what has been done to them. When we actually have to be consistent here. We have to actually recognize that the way that power operates is it shifts and mutates across time and space in terms of who it's targeting, but its goal is always going to be the same. So what's happening here in the United States right now is we have over 330 pieces of anti-LGBTQ legislation that are being proposed, mostly at the state level here, that are trying to do things like criminalize gender-affirming, life-saving healthcare, ban any teaching or curriculum or books, including my book, Beyond the Gender Binary, from school curriculums, that are trying to ban trans people from sports, that are trying to ban trans people from public accommodations like bathrooms, that are trying to criminalize doctors for providing care, criminalize parents for being supportive of their kids. But I try to not dwell on the specifics of these bills because they're actually part of a larger cultural strategy, which is to make it impossible to live a trans and a non-binary life, to threaten and intimidate us so much that people go back into gender conformity or into the binary. Mm. And so then the question is, why are the powers that be so invested in making us disappear? And it's because of our power. And this is the reframe I really wanted to do in my work, and I want to do in this book, and I want to show the world, is that when you grow up with that view of yourself through straight cis society, you think that you're broken or wrong or defective. You think that it's because you lack. that the reason that you're experiencing violence and discrimination is because you're an insufficient man or an insufficient woman or insufficient human being. That is not true. It is because you love. The reason we're being targeted is because the kind of self-love and collective love that we model challenges the very structures of a society that is soulless, dissociated, and disconnected. It's because trans and non-binary people show the world this powerful ritual of being able to accept the parts of yourself that you feel shame in and transform. And that's what society needs right now, transition. What society needs right now is a serious and intimate reckoning with shameful histories and pasts as a way to emerge into a more radiant and powerful future. Trans people template that practice of self-reflection, of sovereignty, and of becoming that fascist powers don't want anyone to think is possible. How do you maintain the status quo? You make people think that it's natural, absolute, and inevitable. What do trans people show the world? Nothing is absolute and impenetrable. Mm. And so trans people actually become ambassadors to change. And change is not a currency that powers that be allow to circulate, because then their power gets questioned. Mm. Then people begin to say, hey, if these gender norms are constructed,
what else?
Maybe all these other norms are constructed, right? And then they began to question the ways in which they were taught coercion was the only way to live and began to argue for consent and autonomy and self-determination and values that trans life embodies. So the reason that trans and non-binary people are being scapegoated right now is not just a coincidence. It's not just because we're the next minority in this rotating game. Mm. It's because of our power. And I feel so sad that many trans and non-binary people can't access that sense of pride and love. And I get it, because I couldn't for the majority of my life. Mm. And it's only something that's dawned on me recently in my transition is I began to really recognize that we have always had this function in society. And the way that I did it is actually during quarantine here, I started to read so much because I was really bored. And I had been on the road for like a decade and I couldn't travel anymore. And so I needed to travel. And so I traveled in the way that I used to when I was a kid through my imagination. And I just started to read and read and read and read. And once again, this is another really important conversation for Germans. Mm. To learn queer German history and to actually recognize the foundational role that we have always played in our societies and the ways that we were forcibly erased and disappeared from culture and history, and to reconnect with our transcestors, our trans ancestors. Mm. So when I started to read about Germany, about Berlin, about New York in the early 1900s, and I started to understand, like, oh my goodness, we've always been here. And not only have we always been here, we found ways to survive and transmit our culture despite attempted disappearance. Mm. Like what that looked like in New York City, where I live, is it used to be illegal for people like you and me to exist in public because of cross-dressing laws. So the girls would make relationships with bars and hide their heels behind the bar and just change on the way, or would carry rags in their back pocket and wipe off their makeup when the police came. It's not that they stopped existing. Mm. It's that they got creative in the way that they existed. Mm. And the only way they did it was through being in solidarity with one another and supporting one another and rallying for one another and loving one another. And when I started to read all of these things, I started to realize, like, hey, my ancestors thought we were worth fighting for. So what was that thing that they thought was worth fighting for? It's the preciousness and sacredness of being queer. And that's a lesson I didn't learn from my parents. That's a lesson I didn't learn from mainstream culture. It's a lesson I learned from my trans ancestors. And I think that that's why it's so egregious to me that they're trying to ban LGBTQ history and curriculum in our schools. Because what if LGBTQ people were actually taught our history. Mm. Imagine how we could take up space. Imagine what we could believe about ourselves if we could look past these lies that they tell us that non-binary is new, these lies that they tell us that we're some sort of millennial fad. Right. If we are permitted history, we're permitted a future.
Right, right. It's most baffling to me always whenever I read about a different topic and then I will suddenly like stumble across a gay historic figure, a queer historic figure. The other day I was reading about gay witchcraft and there was, you know, research about queer people that had lived, that had been erased from every other history book, or they had been trying to erase them. And it always makes me feel so connected and so proud and, you know, happy that, yes, there have been other people like us throughout history who've just been erased from the books because the winners write the books, right? And yeah, it's, you wrote this in one of your books also, that there was, I think in the 18th century, this idea started in Europe, basically mostly in Europe, that a gender was binary. And before there was sort of one gender. This is the sort of thing that sounds unbelievable to me today because I've been raised believing that we didn't exist. I had to rediscover us. Could you explain that a little and elaborate so people understand and learn? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So the gender binary and the sex binary are actually recently constructed phenomenon, even within Europe. Mm. Prior to the binary sex model, there was what scholars call a unisex model, where females were actually seen as, quote, underdeveloped males. There was this idea that we just have one sex, but the distribution of heat actually allowed them to be different. So rather than being seen as a dichotomy, it was different sides of the same coin. And the idea of a dichotomy, which meant that female and male are opposites, masculine and feminine are opposites, actually was created in the context of justifying the oppression of women and the sexual separation of spheres. What that means is, how do you justify saying, okay, only men get political rights, only men get to access the public sphere, and women just have to stay at home? You have to say that, oh, there's a fundamental difference between men and women, so you can justify your social practices rooting in the rhetoric of biology and the body. What this actually erased is the longstanding and sacred participation of women in science, of women in medicine, and women in politics, of women leaders, which is also another history that often gets erased in European history, is that women actually were scientists and making knowledge production, that in fact, midwifery was actually a practice predominantly by women that got disciplined out of the public through the construction of gynecology, which is male domination of the reproductive process. So once again, all of these things that we inherit as absolute and inevitable aren't. And that's why history is so queer, because it shows us that actually all these narratives are just that, narratives, and they're stories. So people tell a story about biology, not actual biology. They tell a story about gender, not actually gender. They tell a story about Germany, not actually Germany. Mm. And what we have to do is to normalize being wrong. And that's something that I love, actually, is being able to have my assumptions of the universe continually expanded. I think learning is the coolest thing in the world. Maybe that's just because I'm a bookworm and a nerd, but I love it. There's no better experience for me than being like, wow, I just learned something that completely made me reconsider my life. And that's why it's often hard for me to empathize when people are like presented with new information and double down on their tomfoolery. Right. Like, absolutely not. Like, I refute. What's that about? I think it's ultimately about a sense of like, if I was wrong, then maybe I won't be loved, because people maybe as kids were told that anytime they were wrong, they would be punished. And so then that gives me a sense of compassion to be like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that you weren't allowed to be wrong without repercussions. Mm. But here you are. Here, getting it wrong is just another way of getting it right.
Right. You wrote somewhere else that there was a, that there were white scientists, basically, like European and US American scientists, who actually believed that only white people could have the gender binary. That's another thing that was mind-boggling to me. Could you explain that a little?
Yeah, sure. Once again, really important in the context of Germany here. So what basically people don't understand is that the same scientists who began to develop these ideas of, quote, biological sex were actually the people who were developing ideas of biological race as a way to justify racism. Mm-hmm. So the way that racism historically was justified was that people of color were fundamentally less human than white people, so that practices of enslavement or colonization were justified because they weren't actually human, right? And so if people would use systems like measuring people's skulls as a way to prove this racial pseudoscience that there were differences between races. Yeah. That were immutable and different and then therefore could justify. That same knowledge was used to justify the distinction of sexes. And that's that sort of relationship is never taught to us, even when we're taught about the history of eugenics. That actually eugenicists weren't just anti-Jew, weren't just anti-disability, weren't just anti-POC, but were also anti-queer and anti-trans. Mm. And eugenicists actually would call queer people racially underdeveloped. They believed that queer people had stalled growth in the process of becoming modern. The term that they used was atavist, which is a way to actually say they were trapped in an indigenous ancestor and that they had to develop. So that's where conversion therapy actually emerges, is doctors were coming up with models to revive the whiteness and white, queer, and trans people who they saw in a state of racial arrested development. Mm. Did they believe the same things about black and brown people? No. When black and brown queer people would come to the clinic or when they would write about them, they'd say the reason that they're queer is because they're black or brown. Mm. That makes sense. They believed that being gender nonconforming was endemic to being black or brown. And in fact, one of the ways that they would justify colonization is they would say, look at these bare-chested women. Look at these men with long hair. Look at these men who wear dresses. They would depict all indigenous people as gender nonconforming, regardless or not if those people were, by the way, because, for example, where I come from in India, men wear skirts. And when colonists would write about people in my country, they would say, oh, look at these men wearing skirts. They're not actually skirts to us. They're lungis or dhotis, which means that they have a completely different context outside of Western gender cues. So they would use these anthropological accounts of the gender nonconformity of racialized populations as a way to say all of these people were wrong and were in need of colonization to civilize them. So the way that this linked to the idea of the binary is that when these scientists were writing about men and women, males and females, they were only writing about white people. Right. Because they genuinely believed that people of color were sexually indistinct and gender nonconforming and had not yet evolved enough in order to display a differentiation between the sexes. So there are people like Kraft Ebbing. I mean, some of our most foundational sexologists would argue that as a society progresses across civilization, you see a more clear distinction between men and women.
Thank you so much for your insight. It's just so frustrating. Tell me, I read that you were referencing hijras at some point as a sort of like third gender in India. And I remember watching a documentary, I think maybe like 20 years ago, about hijras, where they were depicted sort of as feared and dangerous, and they would like steal your children if you didn't give them money at the wedding, and then they would castrate them and make them one of their own. But I also read that, you know, they used to be sacred and they used to be a valued part of Indian society instead of something to be feared. And there's just a disconnect for me that I don't understand. Yeah, maybe you can explain.
Mm-hmm. So what's really important to understand is that hijras and gender nonconforming people in India ancestrally had a really elevated position in society, were seen as spiritual leaders, We're actually seen, we're invited to weddings as a way to bless them. We're invited when a new child was born. But then when the British colonized India, they, for the first time, criminalized all hijras and all gender nonconforming people and criminalized cross-dressing, or what they called cross-dressing, and taught Indian people homophobia and transphobia, and taught them once again that hijras were the reason that they were poor, that they didn't get access to the things that they wanted, and indoctrinated people into homophobia and transphobia. And so a lot of the negativity expressed towards hijra and gender nonconforming people in India is a byproduct of that colonial brainwashing. And what's really sad as an Indian person is that even if people knew about British colonization, they don't know about how that impacted our ideas of gender and sexuality. Once again, even when people have awareness around eugenics, or even when people have an awareness around race, that's never intersectional to extend to gender and sexuality. And this is, I think, what's really sad, is that when we bring up gender and sexuality, we're seen as being political, when in fact we're just being factual and historical. And the obligation shouldn't just be on queer and trans people to remind people that homophobia and transphobia has always existed. It's to show, it's all of us to actually not even see this as a political topic. It's just like an honest, factual account of what happened. And I think as a queer Indian person, it's always been very difficult when some of my biggest detractors and bullies are other Indian people who look at me and say, you're just this way because you live in America, or you're this way because you've been westernized. When I'm like, literally read the room. We've been there for thousands of years. Like, go outside. Like, what are you talking about?
I had a conversation the other day with a friend of mine who is a Black woman, and she loves trans people, she says, but she does not like the idea of them, of trans women competing in women's sports. And I showed her this interview that was like a long time ago. It's, I believe, from the 1920s, 1930s, of a white person defending their opinion that Black people at the time shouldn't compete in the Olympics, because they said they're superior to us physically. We will not be able to win anything ever again. And I was like, do you see that this is like, they use the same fucking wording. They use the same pseudoscience, logic, blah, to exclude trans people from sports than that they used back in the day to exclude Black people from sports. It's the same fucking bullshit.
Once again, it's the same stuff that gets recycled over and over and over again. But this is where I have hope, is that oppressors are deeply uncreative. They rely on the same playbook over and over again. Artists are deeply creative. We're creating new narratives, new looks, new imaginations all the time. So we actually offer a proactive, expansive vision of the future, of what it means to be human and what it means to love and what it means to live in a collective society. The missing link there is history and is comprehensive education. And that's why I'm really committed to writing books. I'm really committed to making this information accessible. Every time I write a joke, every time I write a poem, I'm thinking about what lesson am I teaching people with here? What history am I unlocking for people? Because I feel deeply concerned that ignorance is not a passive state of being. It's organized into people to keep them docile and down. That actually so many of the powers that be profit off of organizing ignorance. So then how do I organize consciousness? What that looks like is every conversation is an opportunity for both of us to learn. Every conversation, every time I'm on a podcast, every time I'm speaking on stage, is an opportunity for me to share history, for me to share ideas. And that was not what I was taught in the university system. What I was taught in the university system is to hold those and become an expert myself, and to like make people feel stupid for not knowing things. And I hate that. Since my earliest memories, I would be watching like documentaries about black holes, and then I would cry because I thought they were so beautiful. And then I would go and speak to like 15 people about like black holes and the Milky Way and like the universe. Like every time I've learned something new, I want to share it with everyone in the world.
Yeah, that is something that I find very beautiful about what you do, is that there's always this, that you want to educate people, and there's always this plea for compassion. There's always this, look, we're all in this together. We can do this together. We shouldn't be fighting against each other. It's disheartening to me to find, even in the niche of our community that we are in, that now it almost feels like we're being pitted against each other, like binary trans people and us non-binary people. Suddenly we have to fight over who gets to be in the spotlight, who gets to talk more, who gets to have attention for a second. And I feel this is so wrong. And that's why I appreciate what you do so much, because it's this constant reminder that we're in this together. This is a fight for all of us. And including like all genders, you said you have this idea of a coalition of genders where if we fight together, we all win. And that's something that I really love.
Right. There's nothing that hurts me more than that internal division. It's such a trap. In the scheme of things, really, like, we are operating on the presumption that we are only swimming around in a fishbowl, when in fact we have entire oceans, entire galaxies. That scarcity mindset is our PTSD. Mm. It's not reality. And we deserve expansiveness, and we deserve growth. And it just is really sad, this idea that we've internalized that our only worth comes from distancing ourselves from other people, that our only worth comes through hierarchy. It doesn't. At the end of the day, a world without gender binary also helps trans women and trans men. Mm. This is not just a non-binary phenomenon. It helps cis women. It helps everyone. Because a world without the gender binary is not about requiring everyone to be non-binary. That's never been what I'm interested in. That's never been what I've advocated for. It's about advocating for gender self-determination, which means only each person can determine their own gender. And if you determine that your gender is man or woman, that's wonderful. Great. I'm fighting for that too. But man and woman aren't the only options. We all deserve to get more options. But the idea that people have that somehow allowing non-binary people to exist undermines their claim to manhood or womanhood shows that their investment is not in masculinity or femininity. It's in hegemony. It's in power. It's in coercion. What they want is the ability to tell other people who they are. So moving beyond the gender binary isn't about shifting your self-identity. It's about not allowing you to police other people's, not allowing you to uphold definitions of manhood and womanhood that are exclusionary. And I think that one of the questions we have to ask ourselves as queer people is, what do we think exclusion gets us? That's, I think, unresolved. We keep on turning to exclusion as if it's going to help us, when historically, once again, every example we have is that when we exclude, we lose. The cis gay movement excluded trans and non-binary people, both in Germany and in the United States, by saying that we were too different. In fact, the same arguments that are now used to exclude non-binary people like me from trans communities were in fact templated by cis gay men just 50, 60 years ago, excluding all trans people, regardless if we were binary or not. And it was that we were too much, that we were too visible. It was this accommodationalist, assimilationist practice that looked at people like Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, who started Pride, by the way, and said they were too gender nonconforming, too loud, too flamboyant, screaming queens who are making the movement look bad, that if they just changed the way that they dress, changed the way that they look, then people would accept them. All of those arguments that are being used now were used then. And what did that get us? Nowhere.
And like you said, none of this is new. If you look at Sylvia Rivera's speech, the All Better Quiet Down moment, which was, I believe, 1973, we already had all the turfy bullshit there. There was this lesbian feminist called Jean O'Leary, who from the stage called Sylvia a man in a dress. And, you know, even this is not new. Like, the turfy bullshit is not new. All of this has been there, and it hasn't taken us anywhere. This, like you said, this excluding each other and separating from each other, separating from our community from within, it's just bullshit, and it never worked out for anyone. So to wrap this up, is there anything, first of all, let me thank you I've learned so much in this little hour we had together. Every time I listen to you on social media, every time I watch a video, listen to a podcast, read a book that you wrote, I learn so much about myself. I learn so much about the world, and I want to thank you. Is there anything that you want, a statement that you still want to make that you haven't said yet, that a shout out you want to give, something you want to talk about? Please do that now.
Yeah, I just want to say that I'm proud of you, and that I'm proud of everyone who's listening, and that I'm just so grateful that everyone is existing in the world right now. And I know that things are really awful right now and might feel impossible, but know that I love you and I'm rooting for you, and I'm so grateful that you're here.
Thank you, my sweet. Likewise, and thank you again for the time that you spent with us today.
Okay. I've got to run out, but I'll catch you later.
Bye, Z's.
Bye.